tutti.
Thank you very much for that very warm welcome. My name is Jonathan Friedland. I'm a columnist here at The Guardian. And welcome to a debate asking the question, is Britain broken? You may be thinking, is this panel broken? To start with, we are awaiting. He's in his car and on his way here. David Willetts, MP. He's on his way here, will be here, we're told, shortly. He's also warned us that he may have to leave at 8 o'clock. I think perhaps he's trying to give us an early sneak preview of what kinds of cuts and efficiencies the incoming Tory government, if there is one, have in mind, shrinking down an hour and a half meeting into 45 minutes, a model of efficiency. And I'm afraid we do have also apologies. He's from his sick bed, from the Reverend Giles Fraser. So my huge apologies. I know a lot of people were very keen to hear him. Nevertheless, we have, even here, in just with two-thirds of our panel, a collection of wisdom and insight that I think you're going to really enjoy hearing and we're all going to learn from. And I'm also very, very keen that as the discussion moves on, after we have a conversation up here, we're going to open it up and hear from all of you. So let me just say something about the two-thirds of the panel we do have here. Polly Toynbee will be known to many of you as the twice-weekly and multiply award-winning columnist of The Guardian. Her observations of Britain, both in terms of its politics but also its social policy, have had her named as the most influential columnist and journalist in Britain. There was a period, and I've forgotten which Conservative it was, who said that the Conservative Party needed to be influenced more by Polly Toynbee than by than Winston Churchill. They needed to look to Polly Toynbee rather than Winston Churchill. You'll remember that Winston Churchill was voted our greatest Briton of the 20th century. Polly comes in ahead of him in new Tory thinking. She has been the author, absolutely relevantly for our topic tonight, of a series of studies looking at life at the very sharpest end in Britain. Unjust rewards, hard work, life in low-pay Britain. Lost children, the story of adopted children searching for their mothers, and an audit, in fact two, that was updated on Labour's record in government called Did Things Get Better? So I'm sure you'll want to join me in giving a warm welcome to Polly Toynbee. Thank you. And on my right here, a figure known to all of you who have followed closely and listened closely to the debates that are ongoing about the place of children and those who have been marginalised in our society. She too has won multiple awards for her work as a social entrepreneur and a psychotherapist. Often takes part in the media and in media debates, but has preeminently the founder of two crucial charities which have won huge admiration for their work, Kids Company and also The Place to Be, which Kids Company supports over 14,000 children and advocates the rights of the most vulnerable. She's pioneered innovative psychotherapy with those children who are hardest to reach and successfully widened the sphere of counselling by delivering it at street level, regularly honoured and but crucially listened to by policymakers. Please welcome Camilla Batman-Gelly. Thank you very much. So the question before us is Britain broken? This debate is very, very live right now. It is certainly going to be one of the big issues and big themes in the coming general election campaign. The Conservatives have made Broken Britain one of their key campaign slogans, but I think it's also true to say it's one of the Tory Conservative slogans that has really broken through and penetrated and entered really the political language. I was going to open by asking David Willetts to give us five examples of why it is that he and his party say Britain is broken, and we will, when he comes here, hope to hear that from him. But to kick us off, let's ask Polly Toynbee. You wrote very recently about exactly this question, just at the weekend, assessing those ways in which Britain is and is not broken. And you've really taken a close look at the slogan. So what's your opening take on that question? Is Britain broken?
Well, I was going to start by saying that maybe it's a sign of brokenness that people are no longer punctual. But I shall leave that out. Where are modern manners, for instance? Oh. We could add that to the general moral panic. I had expected to be answering David, so that I'll have to kind of put his proposition as well as answering. Well, I'm not sure it's his, but it's certainly been David Cameron's, Chris Grayling's, and a large number of prominent speakers in the Conservative Party, creating, I think, a kind of sense of moral panic in the usual way of taking horror stories, anecdotes, terrible events, which are part of all human society always, whether it's, you know, the Bulger case or the Edlinger boys or whoever, and inflating that into being a symptom of something. Never mind statistics, boring figures, nobody trusts statistics anyway. Just say, you know, here is an example of what we've come to these days. I mean, I have to admit that it is what all oppositions do. Labour did it all the time, mercilessly, endlessly. And, of course, you know, Tony Blair famously used the Bulger case himself in exactly the same way, entirely shameless and entirely without shreds of statistics either. But I do think we have to hold on to the fact that human beings always do terrible things to each other. I mean, you know, after Medea, did Greece all look at each other and say, well, that's the end of us then, you know. Mother kills her children, that it's all over.
Is Greece broken?
Was ancient Greece broken? And indeed, of course, ancient Greece did have, as all human societies always have had, a very, very strong nostalgic streak. Golden ageism of always feeling that there was a time. It's usually your grandparents' youth. It's a time just before you can remember when you've heard your grandparents talk about my young day and the golden days and the wonderful times and how obedient children were and how everybody knew their place and how they certainly knew how to respect their elders and so on, through all kinds of distorted lenses. And all the way through literature, right back to ancient Greece, you see that trend, and I think it's hardwired into human nature. So it's a very easy wire to tweak, if you like, and make people feel that everything's worse. But in the end, the statistics matter. And, of course, the figures have to be fireproof, and nobody believes them anymore because all political parties, including the Labour Party, have fiddled with them in various ways at various times. Nevertheless, we now do have an entirely independent Office of National Statistics, who produce the figures, and nobody else is allowed to mediate the crime figures, and without any shadow of a doubt, the crime figures, by every measurement you care to look at, have fallen dramatically. 41% down, violent crime down, all crime down. And you can't really talk about a broken Britain in the term, these apocalyptic terms that are used, if crime is going in the opposite direction. So that seems to me to be something that they have to answer and explain. All right, let's put crime to one side. Will you agree to put crime to one side? We don't quite know why it's going down. It's happening right across the Western world. Labour can't necessarily claim credit for anything. They can claim credit for some things, aspects of it, but since nobody quite knows why. And it may be the huge increase in education, and actually IQ's rising, interestingly. David Willett's own book has The Pinch has a very good exposition of that. Things getting better, in other words, perhaps people getting better. Of course, the other, if you take crime away, the other strand they use is broken families. That's a sign in itself of disaster. Now, I think a lot of terrible things happen to families on separation, in all sorts of ways, and lots of children get very neglected, as Camilla will talk about. But the idea that it is separation itself, per se, without any of the other social factors that go with it, the extraordinary poverty that it mostly brings, seems to me to be wildly wrong. Sweden has a much higher single parenthood rate, many more children brought up by single parents, and they have none of the same social problems because they're not poor. Because those children go to wonderful nurseries from the age of one if the parents want them, their parents want them to, because the mothers can earn enough money, because they live in decent surroundings, because they're not stuck in poverty ghettos. So it isn't, it seems to me, and now increasingly all of the social science evidence is that it's not divorce itself. It's what happens to the children in the course of that that really matters, how much the parents fight. If they behave well, the children can do fine. If the children aren't brought up in crippling poverty, they can do fine. Once you screen out those things, divorce in itself is not necessarily a disaster. Of course, any government would want everybody to stay together happily. But how do you ordain that? Not, I think, with a marriage bribe. There is no evidence whatever, given the incredible financial hardship people are willing to undergo when they do divorce or separate, losing homes, losing everything, often losing their children. The sacrifices they're willing to make not to live with someone they don't want to live with are immense. And so the idea that a small bit of money from the state is going to magically stick people together seems to me to be very far-fetched. And if you listen to the rhetoric and the size and the drama of the brokenness that they describe, the remedies that they produce, oh. And here he is.
Hello, David.
Are very few. Yeah. Now, David, I've already ripped into to Broken Britain. Unfortunately, it's always David Willetts is the one who is always, well, when he's here, always here to talk to the likes of us. Because he is, I have to say, amongst Tory ministers, the one who, without doubt, knows most about social policy and has done for years. He's probably the only one who understands the social security system amongst his colleagues, and the only one who has really read social research in great detail. And his latest book, The Pinch, is extremely erudite, full of fascinating information about the clash there between the generations. So we're very glad to see him. We're very sad he's missed my remarks. But I think he knows what I...
I've read them already, Polly.
You've read them already. You know what I think. I've known you so long, we've argued for so long, that you can take it from there.
Here's what I'm going to suggest. Thank you very much, Polly. I'm going to suggest that... thank you. David Willetts, welcome. We were going to begin with you to set out the case for the brokenness of Britain. And what I'm going to suggest is that you do that. And then, Polly, I'm going to give you a minute or two to respond to what he said, because that is what originally you were going to do. And then we're going to hear very much from you, Camilla. So let's introduce David Willetts properly. We're grateful that he's here. He is the Shadow Secretary of State for Universities and Skills, particularly and relevantly for us. He has responsibility for social mobility and families. He's been in Parliament since 1992. And has worked his way through several shadow portfolios, including Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, also relevant for our purposes. And as Polly has already plugged your book once, The Pinch, we don't need to mention it too many more times. So the question before us, Dave Willetts, is Britain broken? I was going to half-jokingly say, if so, who broke it and where do we send the bill? But do just focus, if you would, kick us off on this phrase given to you by a former leader, Ian Duncan Smith. It has broken through. I said that it's one of the Conservative slogans that has really penetrated the notion of broken Britain. Could you give us, because I want this to be as concrete as we can, four or five examples that illustrate why it is that the Tories say Britain is now broken?
And I do apologise for running late. We had a vote in the Commons and I was trapped in another meeting, which I left early, but I'm sorry I missed Polly's critique, but I do enjoy reading it every week in The Guardian.
And there will be more of it.
And there will be more. Right, so what is broken? Let me give you three or four examples. I mean, first of all, there is the economy, and setting aside all the ups and downs of the economic cycle and boom and bust, I do think that to have reached the position where in the 4 years, 2005 to 2008, we had negative personal saving. We were overall, the entire sort of personal sector in Britain was actually net dis-saving, was, to do it for 4 years is perhaps unique, unprecedented in advanced Western post-war economies. America did not actually manage to get its savings going negative. So we had the personal sector running on debt. And now, of course, we have the government, the public sector, racking up debt at a very dramatic rate. So we had a very high level of personal borrowing, exceptional on any standard compared to with other countries or historical, and now we've got a big increase in the amount of government borrowing. And that ties into one of the arguments in the book, and I'm not going to talk about the book all the time, but that it's a failure to value the future. It's getting the balance between the interests of the present and future generations comprehensively wrong. So that would be the economic indicator I would pick up on. On society and what is broken about British society, I think one powerful indicator of what's going wrong is social mobility and low social mobility. Now, there is a learned debate amongst the experts about exactly what's been happening, and we are terribly dependent on some rather particular observations. But we do know that social mobility for the people born in 1970 was lower than for people born in 1958. And nobody has really been able to argue that social mobility has significantly improved since then, though it may have stabilised at low levels compared with other advanced Western countries. Again, I'm not setting some sort of incredibly high bar here. I'm setting a test of how we're doing compared to other countries, and the Sutton Trust, who are probably the doyen of the researchers here, would say that Britain has one of the Western world's lowest levels of social mobility. And one other social indicator, some number three on the list, the challenge that you set me, and this is something that Camilla is particularly expert on, is the quality of childhood. Now, that's hard to measure, and I know the arguments that when the UNICEF put us, again, bottom of the league across advanced Western countries, there are arguments, well, these were old statistics and such like, and they were. It was certainly a composite index that they created using their own, using a variety of measures which they put together. But I do think that when one looks at play, space, mental health, stress, and when I went to one or two other countries to look at the quality of childhood there compared with in Britain, it did seem pretty clear that we had some deep-seated problems, of which the fragility of family life, which Polly was talking about just when I walked in, is part of it, but I see it as a wider issue of a collapse of trust between the generations, so that what's happened is that parenting has become more and more demanding because it's the parents alone who are trusted to raise the kids. All the other adults are now deeply distrusted, unlike in some other countries where levels of trust between adults and children is a lot higher. Jenny Russell has written about this very eloquently in the pages of The Guardian. So I would have as my third measure, my second social measure, but my third measure overall, something about quality of childhood. And my fourth measure, so we've talked about the economy, we've talked about society, my fourth measure is what's happened to our politics. And I'm complicit in this as a member of parliament myself, who had my share of all the scandals on our allowances and claims, but the level of distrust in politicians, which in turn ties into a sort of level of distrust in whether public policy can do anything to sort out this mess, is clearly running at a very high level, and the credibility and confidence that people have in the political class is very low. So I think there's an economic problem, which is I described. I think there are social problems, and I think there's a problem in the quality of our politics, which particularly puts off younger voters, and they are the ones who are most detached and disengaged. Now, the sort of way I organise that in my mind is that the theme that links a lot of this together is what we as a society are doing to prepare for the future, whether we've got the balance between the interests of us now right, compared with the interests of younger people and younger generations in the future. And I don't think we have, and that does seem to me to constitute a breaking of the social contract in the way in which I, as a conservative, understand it, which is above all a contract between generations.
Thank you. That's extremely clear. Thanks for that. Because you made one of your points was the quality of childhood, let's break the order I was going to suggest, because we haven't yet heard from you, Camilla. And in a way, you're not involved in any kind of partisan fight, but you are absolutely the sharp end, dealing with the people we're talking about in some ways in the abstract here. So just tell us in some ways who's right here, I mean, and perhaps respond to that quite gloomy assessment of the quality of childhood we heard from David Willetts.
Well, I think narratives of organisation are very interesting because you have a global situation called society and all of us living in it. And where we choose to put the narrative of how we organise this society, how we conceptualise systems and structures in it, to then go on and say they're broken or not broken, is, I think, a very interesting intellectual choice. But what I do feel is that at street level, from the perspective of the children that I work with, they wouldn't describe their communities or their environments being broken. What they would experience is that when they come into contact with civil structures, they're experiencing the civil structures as profoundly dysfunctional. And what I mean by that is, for example, when we try and get a child who is at risk into the local social work department, we're now really struggling to take children who are being abused and neglected into the system, as the Children's Act has told us that we have to. So on the one hand, as workers, we're being told every child we find who's being sexually or physically abused or neglected or emotionally abused must be referred to the social work department, and we follow that rule. On the other hand, when we make the referrals to the social work department doesn't want to take the cases because they're probably snowed under and they can't manage. And if you're a child and you're watching this at street level, the first communication that you receive is that somehow your life is not worthwhile. And if your interaction with civil society is one in which your life is not deemed precious enough to be protected, therefore you draw a conclusion that generally as a society we feel that human life is not that precious, not that worthwhile. And I think if I had to speak about a kind of breakdown, I would say that the lens shouldn't be focused on the impoverished or poor communities. The lens needs to be focused on the constructs we've created in order to give our society a kind of structure. And therefore, I think we need to be focusing on civil society's failures to sustain the order of things rather than the community at large being broken.
Thank you. That's a particular... It's a particularly arresting view because, even on both sides, almost a consensus, the politicians do talk about these chaotic families or sink estates where the idea is, putting aside even the disservices that are meant to look after those people, the communities themselves are, in fact, not worthy of the name. They're not communities. It's dysfunctional. It's feral children. It's parents who are who have no responsibility for their children. And what you're saying is actually, no, the communities are... Or what? Are they still cohering and functioning as communities? Are they taking care of each other? It's only when they interact with the system that the problems kick in?
They develop, for example, a very popular viewpoint is to describe the kind of children that I work with at street level as amoral and feral. Mm. But if you actually look at the systems under which they even operate within the drug trade, they're immensely moral. It's just that it's an adapted morality to fit the conditions in which they've been forced to survive on the margins of society. I would argue that however much civil society may not like it, the kind of kids I work with are intelligently adapted to the conditions into which they're born, and they're ensuring their own survival in the absence of adults exercising competency to protect their childhood. So I think the intellectualization of marginalized individuals' distress is trendy, but it's arguably a flawed analysis. I think we should be focusing it on our own impoverished and dysfunctional institutions.
Can I just follow, because it's so interesting. Can you give us an example of, you said that even children in the drug trade are actually abiding by some kind of morality? I'm just very interested if you can give us an example.
Absolutely. For example...
Immensely moral.
The reason, if you want to look at this analysis, if you're a child at street level and you look at the police and you look at the drug dealer and what you're above all seeking is safety, the truth is that the drug dealer, sadly, through perverse means, will ensure your safety as opposed to the police. And the reason is that the police can't get the witnesses to give evidence. So the police, as an audit system, are paralysed in relation to crime, but the drug dealer can distribute justice in relation to the environments that they're in. And the system of justice is immensely well organized in these communities. For example, if a four-year-old girl is attacked by another four-year-old girl in the playground, the family will send round a nine-year-old to take revenge. You know, they won't send an adult. They'll send one that's sort of close enough and is of the same sex. Equally, if it's a 10-year-old boy, then the proportion of revenge is in relation to that. And some people might sit around and say, it's completely wrong to take revenge. But the answer at street level is, if you're seen to allow a disrespect or something that's been done against you to go unavenged, you're considered a weakened commodity, and therefore you're much more likely to get attacked. But if you ensure the revenge takes place and it's proportionate, then you ensure your safety. And it's uncomfortable, but it's true, and it's perversely moral.
Thank you very much. Gosh, I'm very conscious that we will have some sort of frontline expertise in this room, and I really want to hear that when we widen out, which we will quite soon. Polly, Tombia, you'll probably want to react to some of what you've just heard, but I'd also like you to react to the aspects of brokenness that David Willetts introduced that we hadn't talked about, which is a broken economy, broken politics with expenses scandal and other things, and some of those points about social mobility. And it's got to be said, on the quality of childhood, you've now heard sort of two witnesses, if you like, saying something's going wrong. Not, you know, but Camilla's point about structures, but it's still pretty searing evidence.
I think what Camilla says, as ever, is absolutely fascinating and absolutely the right way to look at it, that the chaos is also in the failure of us to care for people who, for children who need care. And I don't think anyone could doubt that we've got a pretty broken system of social workers with huge caseloads, absolutely unable to deal as they would wish to deal with the large numbers of children and spending a lot of their time. Last time we talked, Camilla, a lot of their time finding reasons to turn children away rather than finding reasons to bring children in, because that's the position, not because it's the social worker's fault, but it's all of our fault for not investing enough in that service. Going through David's point, I'll leave the economy because that's sort of for another day. Social mobility, very interesting, the research between 58 and 70. Really, it seems that the evidence on that is that it had actually, interestingly, nothing whatever to do with social policy, good or bad, by governments of those of that time, but of an enormous increase during the years when they came to adulthood in demand for white-collar workers. So that people who'd left school at 16, they were, you know, bright as anything, they'd had an opportunity to stay on. An awful lot of them immediately got sucked up into better jobs because the jobs market demanded it. And so we moved from a two-thirds blue-collar society to a two-thirds white-collar society within more or less that short period of time. It was a very sudden and probably once-only change. So I'm not sure it tells us a lot about the causes of social mobility. As for this government and social mobility, we couldn't possibly tell yet whether they've made any difference. I don't think until the sort of till the children who are in well-established sure starts from, say, about 2002-03 have worked their way through to, say, 23-24, and we see what they're doing in relation to their backgrounds, I don't think we can begin to assess that. Of course, by the time we get there, successive governments in between will claim all sorts of other reasons why. But we do have one little glimpse of hope in that the children now taking GCSEs are slightly less, it's slightly less predictable what their results will be according to their social background than it used to be. So there is now coming to be people who are coming through who would have been expected not to do well who are doing better. But it's really too early to say very much about that. Quality of childhood, I agree, but although I think the UNICEF report did overstate it, I do think that for all sorts of reasons, children are under a lot of pressure. Politics couldn't agree more. I think that David and I would agree on a large number of these things, and we would discuss the causes of it. But in the end, what makes the difference between people is what you're willing to do to put it right and what you think the solutions might be.
Good, thank you. We definitely want to get to that, and before we widen it, we will. My little joke about, you know, if so, who broke it, was only half facetious, because this is a big part of the debate. And in a way, David, Polly's remark that you're the kind of conservative always comes before Guardian audiences, and you're the sort of...
kind of. He's the only one.
He's the only one. You're the kind...
I enjoy it, something. He's good for my soul, you know?
The acceptable phase and all that. But so maybe it's unfair to lump you with this, but partly why the phrase Broken Britain's got so much traction is forces outside the Conservative Party, actually, particularly in the sort of populist right, you think of the Daily Mail, etc., which often says Britain is broken in various forms. They would say that where the rot set in, pardon me, was partly not just to who broke it, but when, in the 1960s, when that's when we lost our compass and the permissive society and liberalisation of all kinds of things, from abortion to the laws on divorce, etc. And even you could, it's topical given that today's International Women's Day, you know, you could sit reading the Daily Mail for a week and believe that Britain is broken because women started going to work. That's when the problem started. So I know that these are views that, in a way, are not ones you yourself have put your name to, but they are part of why Broken Britain has got the traction it has, and they are often there in the sort of slipstream of conservative, with a capital C, conservative arguments about Broken Britain.
Well, I do think that the sort of process whereby the baby boom has surged through society like a sort of river breaking its banks was deeply disruptive, and I do think that what happened in the 60s and early 70s was socially very disruptive. And indeed, one of the arguments in the book is that you had, paradoxically, in the 1960s, the crucial social change was you had a massive increase in early marriages of all those baby boomers who got pregnant, got married. You had a surge in pregnant brides. 25% of brides were pregnant in the mid-1960s, whereas before and since it was fewer than 10%. And these people entered into marriages when they were young and pregnant, and that is, those are vulnerable, fragile marriages. And that sort of, paradoxically, this apparent success of marriage then made it much more fragile, as people needed more exit routes from it. And then, yes, I would willingly accept that in the 1980s, those economic changes, and I still think that they were, although they were painful, that they were necessary, but those economic changes disrupted also some family structures in which the man was the breadwinner. I mean, for good or ill, I think that paradoxically, some of the nostalgia on the right for traditional families and the nostalgia on the left for traditional jobs are actually nostalgia for essentially the same kind of model, where you went out as the man to a well-paid job in a factory and were able to keep your family and were also a member of the union or whatever. So, and that world has indeed gone. But the question is how, compared with other countries which have gone through something similar, how we've handled it and how we're coming out the other side. And I was very careful in the evidence I gave not to focus on the extreme 2%. And Polly regularly in her articles says you can't pick the most extremely dysfunctional families in the worst possible circumstances and say that that equals society as a whole is broken. So I tried to address that line of argument by not focusing on those extreme cases, and instead all my examples were deliberately mainstream examples of the kind of things that would be experienced as pressures and problems by mainstream families. And they were also examples where I am confident in certainly three out of the four cases of the international evidence that comparing where we are now with other countries now we're doing badly. So that's the challenge. Now, rising to the challenge, absolutely right, is crucial. But just getting some sense of the challenge, these are all examples where we are just doing worse than other advanced Western countries now.
Just quickly come back on this thing, because many on the right do demonise the 1960s, the time when it went wrong, and many on the left say it was actually the 1980s because of Margaret Thatcher breaking up communities, etc. So just on the timing, if you like, of where it happened. And then
Well, I think just on the statistics of this, if you look at what happened in the early 80s, we moved very, very suddenly, very abruptly, from having been towards the end of the 70s at the most equal point ever in our history as a society. We moved very rapidly from one in seven children being poor to one in three being poor. and Labour's managed to slightly nudge that backwards, but not very much, it remains an enormous fracture in society, and it wasn't just about the loss of manufacturing jobs in those particular areas. It was a really profound change. And then a little later, in 85, came the big bang, and that took the lid off the top of earnings. And since then, we have seen a soaring inequality that was let loose from that time, just like an explosion going off in the middle of society. Since then, nearly 2% every year, the gap widens between what are skilled and what skilled and unskilled people earn. The minimum wage, a very good thing, but not nearly high enough to be a living wage that people can live on. The majority of people who are poor are in work, quite a lot of them in two jobs, doing jobs we absolutely depend on. You know, whether it's cleaning hospital floors or caring for old people, all of those jobs. And there is no explanation at all as to why we should so undervalue them. And if we didn't undervalue those jobs to the degree that we did, we could begin to pull things back together again. If we could put some cap on what happens at the top, we could begin to mend a fracture that I think is very real and happened then. And it was deliberate policy. You know, we've got a recession now, and in this recession, everybody's expecting unemployment to go up to that sort of level, particularly youth unemployment. Hasn't. Looks as if it won't. Even the Chambers of Commerce today saying looks as if it won't, partly because of taking a Keynesian approach, the opposite of Mrs. Thatcher cutting straight into a recession. And now we've done the opposite. We've spent into a recession and had huge jobs programs for the young. You know, has not by any means solved the problem. We may still get a lost generation, but it won't be such a big one.
Thank you. I want to do one quick go-around on one question, and then I'm going to widen out here. And the quick go-around is really on what we can do to repair. To the extent that Britain is broken, you've all set out areas in which you would accept that something is wrong. What should we do about it? Let's begin with you, Camilla.
I think one of the most difficult tensions is this tension between what's our responsibility to the public space and what's our responsibility to our own individual needs. And I think things go wrong when this equilibrium in some way is upset. And we need to go back to an understanding that whilst we honour our responsibility to our personal needs, we also have a duty for the health of our system, because societies are systems, to honour the public space. And I think in relation to honouring the public space, if we wanted to look at the issue of children, there are 1.5 million children in this country, 1.5 million children in this country, who are being neglected and abused. And the figures come from the Economics Foundation and Action for Children 2009. So they're recent. If you look at the Office of National Statistics, which Polly says is the most independent measure of what goes on, and you look at the figures in the last 7 years, you will notice that every year some 550,000 children were referred to child protection for abuse and neglect, but we only took between 34,000 to 35,000 of them on average and placed them on the child protection register and gave them a social worker. But in order to keep the register low, we deregistered almost the same number of children, some 35,000 children, within the year to make room for new kids to come along. So I would start there first. I would say that our current child protection system is not fit for purpose for the children, neither is it fit for purpose for the workers. And if the fundamental crisis in the child's life is one of the absence of a functioning parent, and that's what they all share in common, what we need to do is create street-level centres where staff function in a collective capacity as an extra parental resource in the lives of the most vulnerable children. The centres can be open 7 days a week. If the parent can be strengthened to do the parenting, we'll do that. Or they can supplement the parenting or completely substitute it. And children can stay with the centre right through to the end of university. It's a much more intelligent, much more cost-effective intervention, and it gives vulnerable and desolate children somewhere they can belong to and through which they can have opportunities to flourish. It's very simple, but it needs the politicians to be a bit daring.
Thank you. So what about that, David Willetts? There's a proposal right there. So somebody who's at the sharp end saying that would help repair something that's broken, but it will cost money. What Camilla's described is not going to be cheap, I wouldn't have thought, and yet your party is committed to cutting the spending on exactly these kinds of services.
How would it be cheaper than what they do? Because they don't actually, at the moment, cost the child who receives help in the local authority. So in the 21st century, none of the local authorities can tell you how much James is costing them. It's outrageous.
Mm. Well, and Camilla's right about that. I mean, one of the things that we are looking at is the... And to be fair to him, one of the things that Ian Duncan Smith has particularly focused on is to try to get the argument to what the costs of failure are so as to make these kind of solutions, looking at them in perspective. The fact that there's going to be less money to spend is not because a bunch of Tories hate public spending. It's because whichever party wins the next election, there is going to be a limit to how much any government can borrow. That's just... So I'm reporting, I'm afraid, a fact, not a kind of strange aversion in the Tory party to spending public money. The fact is that it is not sustainable for very long to be borrowing 12 or 13% of your GDP to keep public spending going.
But it's surely not sustainable to have 550,000 children who are neglected and abused every year, and we just heard that.
Yeah, so the challenge will absolutely be, I'm afraid, all around the public sector. And again, I don't think that this would be very different if Labour won again, because we're hearing a lot about efficiency savings already, and there will be more to come, and the question is how genuine the efficiency savings are and which party can better deliver them. The question is all around the public sector, and there'll be people here working the public services. No, it's already happening. As budgets are being limited or cut, what are the best things to do with a limited amount of public money? That is the new framework for the debate on public services over the next few years, I'm afraid, and there is a debate about exactly how rapidly you bring down the government borrowing and exactly how much you reduce public spending. But there isn't, in reality, any dispute about that framework, I'm afraid. And I know no person who thinks we can avoid it. We are just in... This is a mess that we are now in. When you asked about what the policies were, the policies, therefore, are all going to be about how we try to be smarter and more ingenious and more flexible in what we do with limited public resources. And there isn't a single kind of magic bullet, but I do think that housing I attach a lot of importance to. Remember, we're down to record lows to the amount of house building. I buy the pressure that for a lot of families it's housing and overcrowding that's a particular scandal. It's certainly probably the biggest sort of social pressures I observe in my area. So can you change the incentives so that local authorities and local people can see direct rewards to them if they permit housing? I mean, schools, clearly we've got some very radical proposals there. Tax credits, so there's a fairer deal for the low-income families, particularly one-earner couples. In my area, something that I do think links together several of the problems we've been talking about is the incredible importance of raising the standard of vocational training. So much of the debate is about academic education, but vocational training seems to me to get to the heart of this. It's a drive for social mobility. It's also good for stable relationships, because the more people who can command a well-paid job that enables them to help keep a family, the more likely they are to be in a stable long-term partnership with someone else. So there are a lot of things, and I just feel that, especially in tough times, the task for the next government, and I hope and believe it'll be a Conservative one, will be to go through the extraordinary array of initiatives we've had in the past 13 years from Labour, and critically evaluate which ones have worked, which ones have not, get rid of the ones which haven't worked, sustain the ones that have. We're not going to get rid of all of them. Sustain the ones that have, and provide more freedom so that people who have got particular ideas for making things better are able to give them a try.
Thank you. And last to you, Polly, how you would go about repairing, to the extent that Britain is broken. You did accept in some ways that things are breaking. So what you would do to repair?
I think David...
Given that framework, by the way, of less money, which is important.
David's great talent as a politician is... You're about the only person in your party who can make cuts sound reasonable, plausible, palatable, possibly even pleasurable. Whereas most of the time I've been wanting to have cuts anyway, and there's definitely a licking of lips going on, but possibly not in your case. Well, you say within the framework. I don't think I can accept that. I don't think that it's at all clear. You know, we'll see where we are this time next year and how much growth has taken off and what Treasury receipts are looking like, what the market is looking like, whether, you know, interest rates are still very low, whether the debt is quite sustainable. There are an awful lot of, you know, rather more. We had 60 on our side economists who said it wasn't necessary to think of paying back the deficit as being this urgent and pressing business that seems to have become the national obsession.
But eventually, they were saying, okay, even if it's not this year or next, but eventually.
But eventually and slowly, little by little, is a very different matter, and by growth as opposed to necessarily by dramatic. But I think that's slightly for another day. The only thing I'd say, I won't say much about this, is that the one thing that we need, which is what Camilla said, is politicians who will put it to people straight. All of the opinion polls for years, the British Social Attitudes for years, have shown people consistently saying they think the gap is too great between the poor and the rich. It makes them uncomfortable. They think it should be narrowed. We've had politicians who've been refusing to talk about that at all, virtually not at all, not Labour and Labour. Recently has had the word equality, but really it hasn't been on the agenda. Certainly not talking about the rich. You know, a month before the election, the top tax is going to go up. But I think it's a question of putting people straight, saying, listen, we're becoming more and more unequal. Is that what you really want? If not, here are the options. There are different ways of doing things. Don't imagine that the only option is the Soviet Union, which tends to be what people say, oh, I see that's what you want, is it? You say, there is Sweden and there is the United States. There's the choice. Which way would you rather we went? This is how the Nordics did it over many decades of moving towards a more social democratic solution, in which, in the end, everybody ends up happier because the rich are unhappy, unhappier in more unequal societies, as well as the poor, which is an interesting fact that came from the wonderful book, The Spirit Level, which David Cameron actually mentioned here in this hall. And I think that if you start with honesty and telling people there's no such thing as a free lunch, and here are the choices, the more taxes, better services, and not having this number of neglected children, would you all feel better? At least you can begin by putting options, which at the next election, nobody's going to put any sensible options. It's all going to be, you know, free lunchtime.
Very briefly, Camilla, you wanted to come back.
Yeah, I just want people to notice, with the incredible respect I have for you, that whenever you come up with solutions, immediately people pipe up and say, we're not going to have the money. But then look at it. We're a country that's galvanized enough money to do the Olympics. We're a country that also spent in 1 year on the dome 10 years' worth of the child mental health budget. I think it's the way we make choices that we need to pay attention to.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I think our three speakers have brilliantly laid out the terrain, and now I really want to open up as much as I can. I don't know if we do have roving microphones. Somebody will probably wave frantically if we do. We do. Other people have alluded to, I think there probably is experience in the room that we should hear. So I'm going to ask you to make your contribution, and if it is relevant to what you work in or where you live, etc., please do mention that at all. Okay, so there's a hand there. Perhaps have you got a microphone? To the gentleman there with his hand up, and then if you can get a microphone to the lady here with her hand up. And then we'll go to you two first. I'm going to take these in clusters, and after that we'll take the microphone to the man at the back. Yeah. No, you're doing it fine. We can hear you.
All right, okay. I'm a granddad who was a teenager in the 60s, and I hope I don't bore my grandchildren with the tales of yore. nevertheless, I do feel that the way laissez-faire economics, starting with Mrs. Thatcher and then continuing with New Labour, has dominated every section of our society. And another thing that worries me greatly is, in terms of the media, it doesn't matter whether it's Labour or Toryin, they all think that the sun shines out of Mr. Murdoch's bottom. Yes. And so, consequently...
The pounds do.
Well, exactly. And you know, and the thing is that our youngsters are being sort of drip-fed all this sort of nonsense by the Sun and the Daily Mail, which, you know, which sort of tends to make them agitated anyway. I mean, I am going to sound like a boring old fart now, but the fact remains that when I was a teenager, I was lying down outside the American Embassy, and the kids today are playing Nintendo games, or they're up to their necks in debt because they can't afford universities. So something's gone wrong somewhere.
OK, thank you. That's helpful. Let's go to the... Let's have another hand in that area so we can get the microphone ready. Let's bring it there. And what would be useful, again, as I said, we'll pass it to you, and we're going to go to the person there at the back who's been waiting. But, you know, if it's relevant, if you can tell us your opening position on whether or not you do think Britain is broken, that would be helpful. And a question, if you would. Yeah.
Well, I think, being honest...
Oh, sorry, no, I meant the person in front who's holding the microphone and standing up. Yeah.
Hello, I'm Antonia Cox. I'm the Conservative candidate for parliamentary candidate for Islington South, where we now are. I'd just like to take issue with Polly Toynbee on this question of the marriage bribe, as she calls it. I mean, it's not true to say that everything financial is a bribe, is it? When the Guardian pays Polly for her column, that's a recognition of value. And I think that's simply what is intended, and I'm conscious that this is still uncertain territory. I think that's simply what is intended by the Conservatives as far as marriage is concerned. I mean, I have plenty of friends who are not married, bringing up children on their own, or married. There is a difference when there's a public commitment. It's a signal to those people around them that an attempt is being made to form an enduring partnership.
Thank you.
I think that's worthwhile. And I just wonder why, in that case, you call it a bribe.
Thank you. That's clear. And we'll put it to Polly when we finish this little round of questions. Yeah, you've got the microphone with you, I hope. Yes. If you can pass the microphone to the gentleman at the back who's been waiting patiently, and we'll hear from you. Yeah.
I hope the mic...
Sorry, no. We're going to this lady first, and it'll be you next, yeah. I'm just trying to keep this going in
okay.
efficient. Yes.
I just would really like to speak as a working mum, really.
Yeah.
I work part-time. And I suppose I probably would be classified as one of these classic women's floating voters. My question is about this whole issue of choice, and I just want to offer myself as, a small case study. I work part-time... And I've, over the course of the last government, I found myself homeless. I found myself raising a child alone and doing my best. But I've also found myself coming up against the Child Support Agency. And I have an 8-year-old daughter who I have supported over the last 8 years, who has a father who's worked full time, but who pays £5 a week. David, I'd like to say I've bought your book tonight, so I've spent a month's worth of child maintenance on you.
Wow.
I guess the question I'm asking
He'll
is,
refund
you know,
I
guess the question I'm asking is, in terms of what works, there are a lot of things in the system that are clearly not working for ordinary people like me. And I hear the politicians talking about real people all the time. And I often wonder, am I one of those? Because it gives you the sense that maybe there's some unreal people out there as well. So when you talk about is Britain broken and how are you going to fix it, and obviously I'm just offering myself as a small case example, there are a lot of very practical things gone wrong, and it seems to me that people haven't been asking real people what's not working for them and how can you fix it. And actually maybe asking kids as well.
Thank you. And I think that goes to Camilla's one about structures and the system. But thank you very much for that. Thank you. I don't want to discriminate against people up here. So if there are, good. Now, I don't know if... Do we have microphones up there?
It's working.
You have. Good. So the person who's got the microphone is up there. Why don't you go first?
Yep.
And then we'll bring it down to the gentleman waiting. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have a number of professions, but I have been a teacher.
You might need to hold it a tiny bit closer.
I have been a teacher. Lovely. In that situation where you've thought, shall I call in social services or will they make it worse? Or will they make it better? I have to call in social services, but I'm really worried about doing so. That's not okay. It's not actually okay to say they're overloaded, let's let them off the hook. If they are overloaded, they have to say, I cannot take this case because I cannot manage this case with my caseload. And we have to stop making excuses for them. Another profession I could call myself, I've been someone who married for life. But there's a huge incentive sometimes for men to divorce their wives, especially if their wives have got the money. And I've come across the divorce courts. Well, I have been shocked as a teacher to read the literature. We know that the 10% of children who find themselves in the divorce court, the outcome for them by the time they are 33 is bad. No, 100%. The 100% of the 10% of kids that go to the divorce courts, the outcome is bad by the time they are 33. Not 99%, 100%. So who is to blame? The unfamily courts, in my view. Now, we have social services.
Unfamily courts, meaning they're not thinking of families. Is that what you said?
Well, they're not thinking of the children if the outcome is bad by the time they're 33.
So you're not making an argument that divorce is always bad, but you're saying the family courts are getting something wrong.
I think I'm disagreeing with Polly Toynbee that the issue is not actually how the parents behave, it's how the lawyers behave.
I see.
And
how
the judges behave, and actually whether they lose the files or lose the transcripts. But setting that aside,
the final point about
CAFCAS, which is the social services in court,
again,
the literature for a teacher is shocking. We've got a new role for CAFCAS, but we don't know if they're up to the job. That's in the literature. And in the revised literature, it's we have a new role for CAFCAS, and we hope they're up to the job.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to the gentleman there who's been waiting patiently, and then we'll have you, and that's going to be it for this round. We will have more, yeah.
That's fine.
Gentleman down there. Yeah.
Jeremy Thomas, Jonathan. We hear a good deal about systems and structures, and I'm sure that this is very important. But how far do we also need to pay more attention to the ethic on which society is based? As Madeleine Bunting pointed out in her very telling Citizens Ethics Supplement 2 weekends ago, to make more effort and to evolve more common consent towards valuing people as ethical beings and not simply as economic digits. Indeed, dare I quote one certain Arnold Toynbee, that when societies suffer breakages, they do so not from some blow from outside, but from some inward spiritual failure, some kind of demoralization to which we human beings are not bound to succumb and for which we ourselves therefore bear the responsibility.
Thank you. And this is good. If we can just rapidly bring the microphone down to the front row here. Don't worry, we're going to have another round. We'll have another round. I'll come back to you. Ladies have been waiting here patiently, and then we're going to bring things back to the panel. We will have chance for another go. Yeah.
Thank you. Jean Stogden founded Grandparents Plus.
You need to hold it a tiny bit closer.
Yeah. Okay. Jean Stogden founded Grandparents Plus. Can you please comment on this? Somebody did mention generations. I think there is more going on now between the generations than there has been for many decades. Because our children need us, if not for money, they need us for childcare. 60% of all childcare, I think, is done by grandparents. I'd like you to comment on that. Can I just say, you sitting between my friend and I, 60 years at least of work in public service, social services, nobody regrets what's happened to social care more than we do, where social workers sit 80% of their time in front of computers now, instead of doing the preventive work that we did in this very borough, Camden. There was wonderful preventive work. Secondly, good idea, Camilla, about, half a mile down the road, a centre for everyone. Islington tried it with patch offices. It broke them. It nearly bankrupted them. It is hugely expensive to have these centres. But, I mean, I applaud what you're saying, but the expense of it, as you say, we could spend the money differently. Please, can you comment on those things?
Thank you very much. Camilla, why don't you just kick off with that specific point about it's too expensive, and also perhaps if you can respond to some of the other people off of personal experience, the working mother who, we could put this quote on the jacket of David Willett's book, spent a month of that allowance to pay for the book, etc. We have to make him feel extremely guilty before the evening is over. But Camilla, respond to the very practical point that your very good idea, the lady here says, very good idea, but just it would bankrupt any authority who did it.
It wouldn't. I tell you why. In 1 year in Britain, we spent £198 million locking up at any given time 3,000 children, of whom 80% reoffend within a year. So the centres that we're running, and at the moment one of our centres is taking care of 2,200, it's costing us in the region of 3 million. And the reason it's so cost effective is because through the centre, you can also galvanise the public's volunteering and gifts in kind. So we go and collect all the hotels' reject designer towels and distribute them amongst our families. We pick up all their old furnitures from designers who do up. So it's about doing intelligent business. Consequently, at Kids Company, for every pound that we spend in cash, we bring in another pound in volunteering and gifts in kind. So I do think that my proposition is actually more cost-effective because then our children don't go on to reoffend. They're having their health needs met because the psychiatrist and the doctors are on the premises. And we're not allowing them to get into trouble because we're basically taking care of them. So I would beg to differ. Maybe they didn't run the centres very well where you were.
Thank you. And what about this point about the social services should stop making excuses, you know, where they should be forced almost to say, oh, we're not going to take your child for this reason?
The social services do, but they do it in a sly way. And what they do is they set these things called thresholds of intake. So privately, amongst themselves, they agree that, for example, they will let in sexual abuse with penetration but not touching of a certain age. You won't believe it, but in this country at the moment, these types of decisions are being made. We had a case where both parents were heroin addicts and out of control and the children were starving. They took the 2-year-old because into care but left the 10-year-old because the 2-year-old was within the threshold of intake for drug addicts, but the 10-year-old was over the threshold of intake for drug addicts. So this is actually happening, and I think what we need to do is encourage our leaders in the social care agencies to be honest about the games that are getting played and to refuse playing them for the well-being of their staff and for their own well-being. I think that's what's going on. So it's not the individual worker's fault, but it's collective moral cowardice, I'm afraid, because no one dares speak up.
David, I'm very glad for Jeremy Thomas's question about ethics, because we are lacking Giles Fraser here, who I think would have brought a sort of a different and perhaps more overtly ethical perspective to things. Many people, again, who are part of this argument of the Conservative Party and on the right, do say that the breakdown is actually not just economic or social, but moral, and that something has morally gone wrong in our society. I want to hear what you think about that, whether that's the case.
I don't much like the language of kind of demoralisation myself, because I think out there, most people are trying to do their best in difficult circumstances. And I also agreed with what Camilla said earlier, that even in apparently extreme circumstances, you can understand the logic of the circumstance, of the position people got themselves into. What I think has happened is that some of the ways in which cooperation evolves and institutions and professions function have been undermined. So I see it as, ultimately, failures of public policy, not that people are have somehow become morally inferior to what they used to be. And part of the argument in my book is I try to make sense of the circumstances in which social capital grows, in which people behave in altruistic ways, and argue from the evidence that one of the reasons why institutions matter is institutions provide environments in which people can assist each other reciprocally. And the more you destabilize them and the more you subject them to external controls, then it's harder for them to do that job. A theme in some of the questions we've heard today seems to me to be the role of the professional. And around public services and elsewhere, the paradox is that despite Tony Blair's rhetoric and despite the increases in public spending, my view is that talking to many of them, people feel deprofessionalized compared where even they were 10 years ago. They feel much more driven by a target culture, and that's why trying to give institutions and professions some greater capacity to run their own affairs matters. So I want to look at the drivers as to why behaviour is changing rather than just say people have got worse.
Thank you. And Polly, just respond to two things. The point about the divorce courts, that it's particularly the lawyers and how they behave, that's partly accounting for some brokenness, but also very directly from our Conservative candidate friend over there, the notion of the marriage bribe. She took umbrage, Antonia Cox took umbrage at your use of the term bribe. No one would call your very modest guardian salary a bribe. They would just say it's a recognition. They would say it's a recognition of your tremendous value to the Guardian, and therefore why isn't it the same about marriage and the system?
Well, about the divorce courts, yes, that research is that children where divorces end up in the courts being fought do very badly. What really, really does badly for children is parents fighting, and all of the evidence is there. So Michael Rutter, who is, most distinguished social scientist, has followed through all of the research, starting with Bowlby, that in the beginning said children do badly if their parents divorce. Then that research has been refined and refined and refined by a whole series of different researchers since to find out, well, what are the mechanisms by which, I mean, I mentioned the fact that in Sweden it sort of ain't so, or not in the same degree. It doesn't predict that children will be deeply disadvantaged. And screening out those things, once you screen out for, parents not fighting, when they fight, it is terrible. And what's more, the damage done to children starts long before they actually separate. It happens in dysfunctional households, and even if they don't separate. So it isn't about separation, it's about friction. Often children who've never had a father in the house and don't have friction do better than children where there's been terrible tension. So it's complicated, the social science on that. But you're dead right that the ones that end up in divorce courts and where lawyers, unscrupulous lawyers, milk the cases do worst. Now let's look at the marriage bribe. We won't call it a bribe because it's much more random than that, really. We'll call it, say, let's call it the John Terry tax. This is the tax where if you are happily married or married at all, you get this bonus. If you leave your wife and go off with somebody else, maybe your third wife, you take the bonus with you, your left behind wife and child gets no bonus. If you are, sadly, a widow whose husband has been killed in Afghanistan, you get no bonus. This is madness. It's complete madness. It makes no sense. What's more, because of the way the structure of how we live and that often lack of money makes people divorce much more, the rich divorce much less than the poor, for instance. The poor are much more likely to be single mothers for all sorts of reasons, and because they're single poorer, it's a multiple circular effect. The better off will be 13 times, will get 13 times more of the money from your marriage tax, your John Terry tax, than will be the poorest. So in every way, it's a tax that doesn't work. That even if you thought, I don't know about your friends, some of whom are married, some of whom not, whether you've said to them, I say, if you've got another £1,000 a year, would you marry? An awful lot of people would get married in a hurry just to have that little bit. I'm sure that's true. Whether it would make them stay together, I just doubt. All of the evidence is that the people who are married are a different population of relationships than people who are not. There's usually quite good reasons why people have decided to get married or not.
David Willis, this is your party policy.
Let's
so,
just say one thing about the CSA. Okay. Dead right. Today is International Women's Day. The CSA has
the child
been
supporting.
Child support agency. Utter failure in getting men to pay for their children. Failure from the start. Failure still. Marginally better now. Reorganised lots of times. Doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because if you have a vast body of won't pay people, whether it's for a tax or whether it's for supporting their children, it's very, very difficult for the state to make them. And what we have is a national strike of fathers refusing to pay for their children. And it's an outrage, and it's one of the most disgraceful things, and one of the reasons why women are so poor often, because of that.
Thank you. Very briefly, because I do want to take another round. Thank you. Very briefly, David Willits, it is your party policy. Just defend the John Terry tax that benefits the three-times married man and punishes the war widow.
Right. Well, first of all, just to go back to the...
Just to frame it neutrally.
Just on the divorce question, which is relevant, my understanding of the evidence is slightly different than Hollis, which is that the crucial issue is conflict. And it is true that going through the divorce course is a stressful and conflict-generating exercise, so it's painful for the kids. It's also true that if the marriage relationship beforehand was high conflict, then children may be better out after it's broken down. However, a low conflict relationship, where although the adults are not getting on with each other, they are not overtly in a state of conflict. In other words, they are holding down the level of stress for their kids. The evidence, as I understand it, was that when those relationships break up, coming sometimes as a surprise for the kids, that is very damaging and traumatic for the children. So there are certain... And I think this is, gets back to the question of how has the world changed? One way in which the world has changed is that managing those unhappy circumstances for the sake of the kids is something that people are probably less willing to do now than they were willing to do in the past. So we can't... It is not all for the better that every relationship always breaks up. There are circumstances where clearly the breakup does come as a blow to the kids, and that's when the parents were keeping their... managing to hold the levels of conflict down. And that's my understanding of the evidence, and I think Polly would probably accept that's what some of those evaluations show.
But I treat people who've stayed in those situations as children, and they have very disorganised thinking because they don't know what feeling to believe in and what feeling not to believe in.
Yeah, it is asking for a level of self-control, or if you like, sacrifice that people may be uncomfortable with nowadays. Now, on marriage... let me give you sort of two sorts of ones. First of all, we are not talking about some sort of eccentric conservative experiment. The fact is, most advanced Western countries have a recognition of marriage in their income tax system. Britain is an outlier in not having a recognition of this institution, which is an important public legal pledge in which two people make a commitment, essentially, to support each other in a whole host of ways. In most countries, it's just thought to be obvious that that is relevant information for the income tax authorities. So this is a mainstream feature of most advanced Western countries' income tax systems. We, of course, still have it in our capital tax system, and indeed one of the things that Alistair Darling proudly did in the autumn statement of 2007 was announced it's going to make it easier for married couples to exchange their inheritance tax allowances. It's just somehow supposed to be terribly wrong if you do it for income tax. There are a lot of reasons why you for doing it simply in respect of marriage. I think one argument, which is the one that I think is particularly relevant for Polly, is that it's the least intrusive way of doing it. If you're trying to support a relationship and recognise whether people have a commitment to each other, including for financial support, the advantage of marriage is you don't have to ask people, are you living together? What exactly is your relationship? You have a simple legal document which you can present to the tax authorities. Nobody has yet come to me with any explanation as to how you would really wish the tax authorities to extend this to cohabitation, even if you wish to do so. And my view is that and I'm now going to sort of push the boat out here. The Guardian is completely misreading this issue. The sensible way to have this is to support families in a range of ways through both tax and benefits. Most countries help families in benefits, help families in tax. Sometimes cohabiting couples and married couples, sometimes just married, sometimes depending on the age of the children. The more different ways there are of recognising families in tax and benefits so as to provide financial support for them, the better overall for families. So you should see this as an addition to a range of ways in which we help families. And that seems to me to be the way in which most advanced Western countries are. And Britain is very unusual in thinking you're only allowed to help families through benefits. That is an unusual model which I don't think is in the long-term interests of families.
Thank you. Just because you're in the Guardian building doesn't mean you can rewrite the Guardian lead line, David. Well, here's what we're going to do. We've only got 5 or 6 minutes left to us. I want people to be as brief as they can. We're going to take a quick sample and then a minute each to all of our people here. I'm going to go to the gentleman there because he was waiting so patiently. And yeah, no, you. I'm pointing at you. Don't shake your head in dismay. Yeah, you.
I think that the panellists are too young.
No,
to
who's doing
question.
It? No, you. The man above. Sorry, the man above here has been waiting very patiently.
Sorry.
Yeah. Above, yes, in the balcony. Is the microphone coming? No, it's not. Okay, while we're waiting, why don't you do it there? But as brief as you can, really, because I felt as if it was going to be long.
I was saying somewhere. That I think the speakers are too young to answer this question, because I think you've got to
maybe
be at least 50 to compare Britain today with Britain, say, in the late 50s and early 60s.
Okay.
And to reduce it to simple terms, in the late 50s, there was no... I mean, to go back, Polly
no,
said...
No, I'm worried we're not going to have time for it. You need to have a very quick, sharp
very quick
question.
Polly said that crime has fallen.
Okay.
Crime has only fallen in the last few years. In the 50s and 60s, there was no drug crime, no knife crime, and no gun crime.
OK, I see what you mean. So, in other words, yes, if crime has fallen, it's coming from a very high base. I got it. Are you there now with the microphone?
Good. Yeah, I wanted to pick up on what David said about politics being broken. And okay, I'm quite staggered by how bad the Tory campaign is. It really is astonishing. I mean, you've got an open goal.
Good for this lady.
But I wanted to say, why... Is it broken because you're not offering hope? You're not appealing to people's better sides? It's negative. Cuts, cuts, cuts. It's not a very attractive proposition. It's just chucking people on the dole. It's nurses, teachers. If you were to... I suggest that to get elected, you want to be a bit more positive.
Okay. Thank you. Lady here.
Hello. I teach in a sixth form college. Almost all of my students don't have fathers, I know this, and many are very poor. I want to ask Camilla, can you educate people to be good parents? And if you believe you can, please can you write a syllabus so that we can teach it?
Thank you. That's very, very practical. Thank you. Yeah. Gentleman here, we could note in there, because we'll keep it quick and it will be you after that. It's quick.
Question for David Willetts. In the choice that he expects a Conservative government to make, would he expect them to build on Sure Start?
Thank you. Was that your question? No? Okay, then you're next. I'm only taking this group because they're right in a cluster and it's very convenient. Yeah.
I don't think I should come to things like this because I become quite incoherent with rage when we, as a civilised, wealthy nation, so glibly turn around and say that we can't afford to care for our children. That really does worry me so much. And just to add that my feeling is that our political system is broken, and it is broken because our voting, our electoral system, is so essentially unfair. And why on earth you can't see that, I simply do not know.
Thank you. We're going to get three more in. That's all I've got time for. You're one of them. Yeah.
I don't think Britain is broken, but I do think we've got too much bureaucracy. And I think we should rely much, much more on people. Our biggest resource in this country, half of it's run by voluntary effort. And to do with children, we could have centres all over the place. If we invested in people and getting people, somebody can come and talk to a person, and we invest in parents as well as children, and forget whether they're married or not, you know. This has got nothing to do with it. That's where we spend the money on people and let them talk and deal with other people.
Thank
and
you.
Then we'll...
Thank you. And this will be... The lady at the back is going to be the second last. Yeah, you've got the microphone. And they may pass it forward and it will be the lady in front of you. Thank you.
As a recent graduate who spent quite a large proportion of last year unemployed and on the dole, I'm quite concerned about the lost generation as well. But I particularly want to know what are you going to do to improve it, especially with the cuts? And especially I want to know if higher education has been devalued by this idea that we can have 50% of the population educated to that high level.
Okay. I'm going to go to you if you have a microphone there. Do you have one? Oh, you're good. It's right by your hand. You're very lucky. Yeah.
Thanks, Jonathan. Just quickly, we only briefly talked about housing in the debate tonight. We've got a situation where the existing housing stock's obviously going downhill and there's nothing being done by the government to sort of replenish the housing stock and refurbish it properly. That's where our kids are living at the moment. And the other thing is affordable housing. I work as a planner for a local authority. I'm fed up of asking developers to give us a few crumbs from the table in the way of affordable housing. It's not working, that system. We need to get much more money to social housing associations, whatever, to get better housing stock, affordable housing stock for the kids.
Thank you. And this is the last one, the person with the microphone here. Sorry to everyone else who didn't get a moment. You're the last person. Yeah.
I just wonder whether... I don't think Britain is broken. I think Westminster's broken.
I think that if the parties in Westminster would listen to the people on the ground, like Camilla, to nursing staff, if they listen to teaching staff and people who are conducting surveys which inform policy, then perhaps we might start turning things around.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So very sorry to be pushing people and rushing you that much. I just wanted to cram as many voices as we could in there. Apologies to those who didn't get a chance. A closing minute from each of you. There's so much there you can pick from. You should be more positive, David Willetts. Could we educate, have a course to educate people to be good parents? What about a sure start? So much bureaucracy. You want to invest in people, listen to the voices on the ground. What about the housing stock, higher education? And the lady who said she was incoherent with rage, but then made the very coherent remark that society is broken if we can't afford to care for our children. So, David, why don't you kick us off?
Well, let's rise to that challenge of being positive, because I do think we can be positive. The argument is not Britain is broken, therefore we all break up and give up. And the message is, so what do we do about it? And there's a theme to several of these interventions I completely agree with, and which was where my party came in, which is... fewer central targets, fewer instructions, less central planning, more trust of individuals, especially the professionals, more trust of local institutions, greater diversity, more social enterprises. This is absolutely one of the things that we want to do. This is what we are committed to. That's what we see as a source of rebuilding social capital. On the economy, at the moment, tomorrow we're producing a report from James Dyson, which is all about how you encourage the high-tech industries of the future, which will be the basis for future prosperity. And bringing down government borrowing operates on two sides of the equation. Part of it is getting a grip on the public finances. The other thing is growing the economy faster. And that's absolutely essential for all this. And finally, on fathers and parenthood, yeah, I do actually believe that here, these social institutions are also have got continuing potential strength. The evidence I see from America is that if you naturalise morality, in other words, if you don't preach at these fathers, but say to them, sometimes literally, this is what happens in the animal kingdom. Have you seen what a male emperor penguin does to care for the egg? Have you seen what happens in the animal kingdom? Some of those fatherhood campaigns in America have been incredibly effective by getting, and I think this is a kind of moral argument that will become more and more important in a diverse society, moral arguments that try to get back to observation about the natural origins of moral obligations. And I think the most natural of them all is an obligation between the generations, and that's the argument that I try to put at the heart of my morality in my book. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Dave, very much. A closing minute or so from you, Camilla, and some of those questions were very pertinent for your own work.
I think the most important thing is that you learn experientially, not just simply by being taught something, but by ending up believing in it because you feel it. And it is for this reason that, above all else, we need to prioritise quality human relationships. So I suggest, rather than build lots of expensive buildings, that we invest in human relationships for vulnerable children, and in terms of parenting, we actually show what good quality care feels like so that young people pick that up and go on and use it. In terms of practicalities, I would say that freeze the passport and the Oyster passes of all fathers who are not paying for their children. And the other thing I would do is that I would import French prefab chalets and put them on the grounds where they're completely, you know, empty grounds, and at least accommodate families. They look really rather good and would be good as a temporary solution.
Thank you very much. Very practical thoughts there. Closing. Thank you. And a closing minute of responses from you, Polly Toynbee.
Quite right. Prefabs were incredibly popular and lasted much longer than anybody expected, and people loved them. They were hard to winkle them out of them when it was time to move them. I do share your rage and often incoherence, kind of sometimes sense of kind of teeth-rattling fury, and you're quite right that the electoral system, changing that, would make an awful lot of difference, and people think it's a dry, dull subject. But at the heart of all this passionate politics, that's the only hope of getting something new and better, seems to me. I do think we can be optimistic, though, and it's very important in looking at all the things that are dreadful and wrong and not good enough that we remember that some things have worked very well. I mean, for instance, on housing, the Decent Homes Scheme, never written about, spent a lot of money on putting right council housing, social housing of all kinds, stopping it deteriorating, and a lot of that has gone on, and that's been good. Sure Start, I think, is just one of the great hopes for the future. But it needs money. It needs the kind of children's mental health service that Camilla talks about. You know, it needs speech and language therapy. Can't be done by volunteers. It needs professionals who know what they're doing. Terribly important. But let's hold on to those things that are good and build on them, and don't let's get into a state of mind of gloom saying nothing works, it's all hopeless.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. A couple of closing things to mention to you. The highlights of this debate will be available in podcast form on guardian.co.uk. Andrew Brown, our colleague there, will be blogging about the event on Comment is Free. You get that by guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And the audience, anybody who's been here who didn't want to get to the microphone or couldn't get to the microphone, you can continue to debate the issues there at Comment is Free. I want to say a special thank you to David Willetts. His people threatened that he might have to leave at 8 o'clock. He, as you can see, and in what I would call a compliment to the quality of the debate, he has stayed with us to the end. I'm sure you're going to want to join me in thanking him, Camilla Bakmangeli, and Polly Toynbee. Bravo. Thank you very much. Thank you. And I think...
and pick up the dead, please.
Yeah. Very good. You better do that. I think he's going to do it.